Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So the big guy, President Biden, had a presser yesterday to address what he is and is not walking back in over the last several weeks of you say gaffes, I say misstatements, you say complete misunderstanding of the situation. You remind me that he's been wrong about every foreign policy decision in the past 40 years, so why should he change now? This is his exchange with Pete Ducey from Fox News, of course, on the regime change comment that was walked back by Blinken, that was walked back by his U.S. ambassador to the U.N. over the weekend, that he says there's no walking back. What's been walked back?
Are you worried that other leaders in the world are going to start to doubt that America is back if some of these big things that you say on the world stage keep getting walked back?
What's getting walked back?
It made it sound like, just in the last couple days, it sounded like you told U.S. troops they were going to Ukraine. It sounded like you said it was possible the U.S. would use a chemical weapon, and it sounded like you were calling for regime change in Russia, and we know
none of the three occurred.
None of the three
occurred? None of the three.
Mr. President?
You interpret the language that way. I was talking to the troops. We're talking about helping train the troops in that are the Ukrainian troops that are in Poland. That's what the context. I sat there with those guys for a couple hours. That's what we talked about.
So when you said you're going to see when you're there, you were not intending
to say meeting with and talking with the Ukrainian troops that were in Poland.
And when you said a chemical weapon use by Russia would trigger a response in kind,
it will trigger a significant response.
What does that mean?
I'm not going to tell you. Why would I tell you? You got to be silly.
The world wants to know.
The world wants to know a lot of things. I'm not telling them what the response would be. Then Russia knows the response.
And of course, you're so cagey. A response in kind, the dictionary definition would be, in context, would be you use nukes, I use nukes.
Right. It's a response in kind.
We have nukes. We could use them. You poison peace negotiators and Russian oligarchs. Well, then I can poison people, too, because we have poison here. That's the quality of the responses you're getting from this president.
So, he said he's not. He said he was declaring moral outrage, not a regime change.
So that was a follow up from another reporter, because the D.C. press corps can only hold a single thought in their head for the collective D.C. press corps for 45 minutes. And so that was their one thought, is continuing to press on the regime change comment he made in Poland.
Nobody believes we're going to take down. I was talking about taking down Putin. Nobody believes that. Number one. Number two, what have I been talking about all since this all began? The only war that's worse than one intended is one that's unintended. The last thing I want to do is engage in a land war or a nuclear war with Russia. That's not part of it. I was expressing my outrage at the behavior of this man. It's outrageous. It's outrageous. And it's more an aspiration than anything. He shouldn't be in power. There's no, I mean, people like this shouldn't be ruling countries, but they do. The fact they do, but doesn't mean I can't express my outrage about it.
No, of course not.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
And you know how he knows he was just expressing his outrage about it.
Right.
Because right here on the talking points, tough Putin Q&A talking points, If you weren't advocating for regime change, what did you mean? Can you clarify? Answer, I was expressing the moral outrage I felt toward the actions of this man. I was not articulating a change in policy. And it says it right there, so I know that's his position somebody wrote it down for him.
That is so sad.
And, oh, by the way, he's not going to tell you what he is or isn't going to do, because then Russia would know. He just told you he's not interested in using nukes or having a land war in Asia. So,
but he told the 82nd Airborne. I mean, we played it yesterday, the 82nd Airborne. You know what's going to happen when you're in your tanks and people are, moms and babies are in front of you not wanting to move.
He said, when you're in Ukraine, you're going to see these things.
Okay.
We don't have tanks there. The 82nd Airborne isn't operating tanks in theater. But the point was, he said, 82nd Airborne, some of you have been there when you're there. That sounds like a deployment to Ukraine. It doesn't sound like I was talking about the training they're doing in Poland. When you're there, you're going to see these things that the Russians are doing. Well, how do you see them from Poland?
I don't know. President Putin, I mean, he's going to use Biden's remarks as propaganda or provocation, don't you think? I mean, he's listening to every word Biden says and is probably laughing at him right now.
It's not about laughing. It's about seizing opportunities. The opportunity to, as we talked about with Jim Carafano yesterday. Well, see, I told you this is about taking out a head of state, which is, via runs afoul of international law. It's a violation of formal U.S. policy after the period in time where we would, dispatch the CIA to take out leaders in places like South America that we didn't like. That's not the policy of the United States. It's a violation of international law. But he's saying it anyway, that's what his mind's eye is going to respond in kind. This is all, again, a war of aggression on the West. They're coming for us rather than Putin is coming for the Ukrainians to fulfill his czarist fantasies. But it's not true, but that's what Putin will say. So why would you give that sort of communication ammunition to a tyrant like Putin? Well, because you're incompetent. That's why you would do it. And that's what Joe Biden is. And again, for all of the talk of somebody not at the height of his mental faculties, this is who Joe Biden's been for 40 years. Go back and listen to Joe Biden pronouncements on any range of topics over the last 40 years. And this is the dolt that he was when he was at the height of his mental faculties, whatever that constituted at the time. And so now we have peace talks in Turkey scheduled
Istanbul
for today.
They already began. Yeah.
And how's that going to go? I mean,
Zelensky's asking for a ceasefire. But last time they had a ceasefire, it didn't last. And that's when that beautiful family of three got killed trying to escape.
Yeah. And Zelensky is also suggesting that they will abandon any desire for nuclear weapons. They will move to neutrality when it comes to essentially NATO versus the old Moscow Pact countries, meaning Russia. But, you've provided more disincentive for Putin to start to offer a vision of what a ceasefire would look like. Because, look, he can continue pounding away in Ukraine for the next 6 months, year. He may never take Kyiv, but he can turn the country into a parking lot the way he has Mariupol. What's his disincentive? He's worried about more 60-year-old soldiers being used as cannon fodder? Hardly. You think he has concern for life, including Russian life? No.
No.
So, for all this talk about Biden has managed this so well, even Petraeus saying that over the weekend, despite this regime change gaffe, that gaffe doesn't quite capture it. That's such a obviously 101 level ridiculous statement to make.
I don't know, what would you call it?
Nobody who has sort of any base level of competence would make that sort of statement. And by the way, he's not the only one. I mean, it was a couple weeks earlier where Lindsey Graham talked about assassinating Putin publicly, which is also reckless and irresponsible and ridiculous and unhelpful. But that's what these guys are. They're political hacks, and they get all caught up in the virtue signaling of the moment. I don't need to know what I'm talking about because I have my moral indignation. They're no better than these suburban housewives with the hate has no home here and Ukrainian flags in their yards.
And seven out of 10 Americans, the NBC did a poll, expressed low to no confidence on Biden's ability to handle the war in Ukraine. That's a big number.
Paul in New Lenox.
Hi, guys. Great show. Yeah, remember that movie Crimson Tide with Denzel Washington and Viggo Mortensen when they questioned Gene Hackman's ability to whether they should send the missile out or not? When's America going to wake up and realize that we're in the same position with Joe Biden? That's my comment.
Thanks, Paul.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. What did Chris Rock wake up with the day after the Oscars?
Oh, no. What?
Fresh Prince.
Hey.
Hi-oh.
That's a good
that one.
Going oh, no, yeah. That's a really good one. Yeah. You didn't hear any more? And anybody else? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36, type in DA, then a quick comment, because Will Smith publicly apologized. Do you want to put this to music, or should I just get over with the main line? Violence in all of its forms is poisonous and destructive. My behavior at last night's Academy Awards was unacceptable and inexcusable. Jokes at my expense are part of the job, but a joke about Jada's medical condition was too much for me to bear, and I reacted emotionally.
This after other deep thinkers came out, like Judd Apatow. He's the director of comedy movies, like, one with Katherine Heigl and that unfunny big dude from Freaks and Geeks. Not Jason Segel. Seth Rogen.
Okay.
That's who. Judd Apatow. He could have killed him.
Well, if he fell back on his head, he could have killed him. Okay,
yeah, and if a piano had fallen out of the sky after he was slapped, he could have died. That's pure out-of-control rage and violence. They've heard a million jokes about them in the last 3 decades. They're not freshmen in the world of Hollywood and comedy. He lost his mind. Another joke going around that his marriage, Will Smith's marriage, is open to everything except jokes.
Oh, that is so good. I mean, they got married, in 1997, and after having the kids, they decided to have an open marriage, and they even invited one of her boyfriends back to the house and met the kids and had a little life there. I mean, it's just weird that, he's putting his future in jeopardy by leaping so violently to her defense when he just lets men have their way with her. It's very odd.
We know this because Jada Pinkett Smith has talked openly and publicly about it. Open marriage. Mm-hmm. By the way, there's a terrible new Ben Affleck movie that's sort of along this thematic called Deep Water. I don't really recommend you see it. I see bad movies, so you don't have to.
What's the premise of the movie? About
just what I said, a cuckolded husband like Will Smith. Jason Whitlock wrote about this. Maybe we're not focusing as much on Jada Pinkett Smith as we should be. Because if you watch the video from Sunday night, what you see is Will Smith initially laughing, Jada Smith not laughing, then Will Smith getting angry. It was almost like it was her cue that she's angry and he better do something about it. A cuckolded man. Jason Whitlock writes, modern Hollywood is Satan's content farm. Smith's violent response to a relatively harmless joke was simply more social media-friendly content. That's true. He argues that the pursuit of fame, which is what Will Smith chose, is the antithesis of the pursuit of God, which he suggests Will Smith is actually interested in. Maybe he knows Will Smith better than we do. I don't know. But that's what he suggests. He suggests that Will Smith made a trade-off to pursue fame rather than pursue God, and the two cannot coexist. Fame requires you to give in to narcissism and promote idolatry. Idolatry is at the root of all sin. The Smiths are American idols in pursuit of fame. Yeah, and I think part of that, too, you know, that whole imperious attitude, like, you can't joke about me, Jada Pinkett Smith. You can't joke about us, the two of them, because we're Hollywood royalty. We're off limits. He goes on to make a comparison I'm not sure is 100% on the mark, but he writes, does Whitlock, Will Smith is no different from Kanye West. They want to serve two masters, God and Hollywood. Will Smith and Kanye West hate themselves for the deals they've struck with fame, women, and their wives. 13 years ago, West ran on the stage at the VMA Awards, snatched a microphone from singer Taylor Swift, and basically stated the award Swift won disrespected Beyonce. Kanye cracked before Will Smith, but it was only a matter of time before the PG rapper joined his X-rated peer. When you live a life in objection to your values, you lose control of your emotions and your discipline. Fame incompatible with godly pursuits. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. And then there's a kicker here, too. Whitlock makes a larger comment about black men. And for those who don't know Jason Whitlock, he is one. Black men have lost control. We've been completely emasculated in our homes, in the workforce, in popular culture, and across all social media platforms. The underlying message to every commercial promoting the strength of black women is that black men are weak, unreliable, and worthless. Jada Pinkett emasculated her husband when she aired her infidelity and convinced him that he would be happy in an open marriage. It's an interesting suggestion that it was her idea.
Yeah, no, it was her idea.
And
yeah.
She pushed it
and
in.
She met her boyfriend because her younger kids introduced her to him. He's 25 years younger than her. And they dated for about 3 years.
Smith is weak and easily manipulated by his out-of-control wife, writes Whitlock. Will Smith has bought the garbage feminist belief that men need to get in touch with their emotions and express them publicly. Black women have aligned with social media apps and making black men killed by white people their favorite form of black men. Black Wow. women have aligned with secularism. The godless love dead black men above all else. Will Smith is cracking up trying to stuff the values of a square into the round holes of Hollywood. He made a buffoon of himself defending the honor of a woman who refuses to honor him with fidelity and privacy.
Wow. This is good.
Chris Rock didn't turn Will Smith's marriage and wife into punchlines. Jada did that. When in pursuit of additional fame and idolatry, she made their private lives public.
Yeah, with that show she does with her daughter and her mom, the three of them, talking about everything and anything. I don't even know what it's called. I think maybe the Pinkets, but
yeah,
it's like girl talk, you know.
Was Will Smith, getting all psychoanalytical here, Will Smith ran up on stage to slap himself, is sort of what Jason Whitlock is saying. Or that was an expression of the contradiction Whitlock alleges Will Smith is trapped in. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line, Clay and Wheeling.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. First off, calling it right now, this was staged. You know, lowest of all time viewership, and now everybody can't keep it out of our mouths. I'm calling it. Second,
no, viewership was actually up 56% from last year.
Second lowest ever, though.
Right, but it couldn't get any worse.
Not staged. You're wrong. But
second, this is the first time national media has picked up black-on-black violence.
There you go. Right. There's the joke circulating. There you go.
And what are we, 12-year-old girls? If you're going to take a stand on your wife, you don't slap somebody. You hit the guy. You pop him in his mouth, and you make a statement. Thanks, guys.
If you watch it, though, again, I'm repeating what you said, but he was laughing, and she was having none of it. Mm-hmm. And he just stormed the stage. He's like, where's security, though? You can just storm, or because it's him, because, you know, he's the second coming, you can just let him jump up on stage. and have his way, do whatever he wants, because who's going to stop him because he's God in Hollywood? Please.
Pete, Milwaukee.
Good morning. You know, in this day and age of super hyper politically correct, any crude white guy who's very careful what they say with their roots, comedian is careful with what they say. But you listen to these guys' nightclub acts, and there is no boundaries. They say anything and use any words they want, and I think it's very double standard and two-faced when they go about this. Now they're hurt, they're crushed, and everything else. It's just ridiculous.
All right.
This show is called Red Table Talk, by the way.
Mike Plano.
Hey, guys. I like the people that are trying to attach what Will Smith to manly behavior. You know, say, oh, he's standing up for his family. The guy's a total simp. I mean, he sissy slapped Chris Rock, and he lets his wife sleep with other men. What else do you need to say? But, you know, one last thing I want to say, Dan, you mentioned Jason Whitlock. I follow him a lot, too. He's a great guy. I don't think he knows Will Smith at all. But the last couple of years, he's gotten very close to his faith, to where, you know, he speaks on everything now from pretty much a biblical worldview. He can go overboard with it at times, but I still agree with a lot of what he says, and I commend him a lot for having the courage to speak truth to power and, just speak truth for what, not just black men, but what all men need to hear.
Thanks for the call, Mike. Yeah, I mean, the Kanye-Will Smith comparison isn't exactly on point, because I don't know that Will Smith is dealing with some of the mental issues that Kanye is apparently dealing with. But I mean, but the larger idea of you cannot pursue fame and pursue God at the same time. You're making a choice there. They're mutually exclusive. That's an interesting idea. I mean, the idea that you could diagnose from afar the reaction of a cuckolded man, particularly in the context we just provided. He laughs, Jada Smith doesn't, then he goes up and offers the slap and the tough talk from the audience. I mean, you know, I think it's interesting. I think that's an interesting perspective, whether he knows Smith or not. Maybe he's projecting onto Will Smith some bygone interest in living biblical values himself. Or maybe he's just wishing Smith would understand that you can't, that he should be choosing that, but he can't because he's this cuckolded man that's chosen fame over more, you know, sort of honorable values. Not sure, but it's you know, if we're going to try to get some value out of this silliness and not just dismiss this to the arrested adolescence that is Hollywood, then I think that's actually a more interesting conversation than listening to what Judd Apatow and comedians and the Oscars are in a crisis comm meeting like it's 13 days in October. I mean, that's all just overwrought nonsense, and it's an indictment of our celebrity culture that we pay this much attention and ascribe this much value to these people who, as I said yesterday, are generally uninteresting people who have interesting jobs. This piece about the Whitlock offers up, I think, gets us to a more interesting place, more heady place that has relevance in our lives as members of a culture and a celebrity culture at that. And maybe we should be thinking through those things. And maybe we should be thinking through them in the context of whatever, the idolatry in our own lives and the idolatry we allow to infiltrate the lives of kids. To boil it down, Charles Barkley from 15 years ago, they're not role models. All they do is remind us why they're not. Derek in North Aurora, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, guys.
Morning.
Just wanted to call in and say I'm one of the few that are still like a real big Chris Rock fan and everything, and I'm really happy that he didn't make a joke about Alec Baldwin's wife.
Alec Baldwin's wife, Hilaria? What, like that she's she's a fake Latina or something? What?
He's pretty good with, handling guns, so we don't know if he was packing in the crowd.
Okay. All right. Thanks for the call, Derek. Yeah. Okay.
Let's move on.
Needs to workshop that, I think.
No, I don't get it.
Orlando on the north side.
Hi, I just wanted to disagree with the previous caller that said it was staged, because he has a history of slapping paparazzis. Just did it recently, like right around Christmas, and it made news, pushing paparazzis away. And I don't know, it looks like he has some violence streak going on or something.
You know, the whole thing, thanks for the caller. This is the whole thing. It goes back to Whitlock again, you know, the emasculated man who has a public profile like Will Smith has. He's got to show everybody that he's a tough guy and that he's not emasculated. And he can't do it in his house, so he does it publicly. Is that so difficult to believe? Is that such a stretch? I don't think so. Mike Yorkville.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. You know, we've viewed this video several times, and you know, there's people, I don't have as large as a circle of people as you do, but the first initial reaction when they seen the video was like, whoa, what just happened? And then they look at it again, and then they look, and I know you already disagree, many of them said this was staged. You know, and one of the biggest reasons they said these people are actors. Many things have been going on that have been keeping us distracted away from the things that have been going on in this world. And what else to do it better with more actors, you know? And mm-hmm. I do agree with Whitlock's point of view. I would say the one part I agree with most is the secularism that has crept into our lives, that we have pushed God out. And we no longer understand the difference between what right and wrong and what's appropriate to say and what's not appropriate to say. And I understand comedy is comedy. And I do agree. Maybe try and make a slighted joke, who knows. But the previous caller said those men that go to those nightclubs say far worse. And we have heard it.
Well,
why
see,
to go
yeah.
ahead and get upset now?
Well, it's not about, yeah, thanks for the call, Mike. But it doesn't make any sense. What's in it for Will Smith? What's in it for Will Smith? A night where he was the odds-on favorite to win the best actor.
It sucked the oxygen out of the room for his own award that he won.
They say much worse. You're missing the point. It's not about it's not about comedians using profanity or making, you know, the previous jokes Chris Rock told at Will Smith's expense, you know. He was slighted for concussion, but he also has to explain why he got $20 million for Wild Wild West. Professional jokes. It's a different thing. Wife. The wife of a cuckolded man.
Yeah, I mean, how humiliating for him that she had this relationship and begged him to do the same. And then brought him to the house. And, I mean, God, it must have been out because he didn't want to divorce her because he loves her. But real quick, Denzel Washington, though, he's a great actor, obviously, but a man of deep faith in God, and he apparently pulled him over and just let him know, you know, to give him support and remind him that, according to Hollywood insiders, that he's being gunned for by the devil. Like,
yeah, here's what Denzel had to say to him.
Wait, hold on now. I mean, Will, you got to keep the fire on the inside now. You can't be out here slapping people at the Oscars. We didn't work hard to get hit now. But I understand. I mean, I knew you had it in you, but I didn't think you were going to get up there and slap the taste out of his mouth. I mean, it's spit residue on the stage. You understand me? He can't taste tonight. Whatever Oscar dinner he was going to is canceled now. Because with tasteless jokes comes tasteless sensations. And now he won't be able to enjoy food tonight. Okay? But you got to understand. You got to be careful because when you get to your highest point, that's when the devil tries to come at you. Okay, so you got to be careful. All right? All right, going back to your seat now. Tell Jada, say, hey, right, you slapped why I don't, that's my will. That's right. No, go on. Go sit down.
Yeah.
Where did you get that video? Where did you guys get that video?
I'm friends with Denzel.
Oh, really? And he just put the voice recorder on his phone?
Yeah. He sent it to me. Said this is what I told him.
Was this an impersonator?
Maybe.
Oh, you guys got me good.
It's good impersonator, isn't it?
That is really good.
He's got the cadence down beautifully. It's very, very good.
But apparently he did say that, you know, that the devil's...
I know, you just heard him.
You guys are so bad.
David and Lansing.
Don't be fake news.
Good morning, guys. I think the news on the right has picked up the leftist tabloid magazine in the grocery store. and they are reading the whole article, and they're suckered into this 2 years ago, pandemic, maybe released on purpose, maybe a bioweapon, and then Moderna has a patented possibly part of the genetic code of the virus from 3 years ago. I'm focused on that, not on a tabloid magazine. I think this story should die out now, or this right has gotten suckered into this.
Uh-huh. All right. Thanks for the call, David. Well, in the 6 o'clock hour, we'll get back to important things like that school that Oprah's opening on Mars. Rich in Indian Head Park.
What?
Tabloid stuff.
Okay.
Rich, Indian Head Park. Rich!
Rich, wake up. Oh, you could have been somebody today.
Rich!
Hello. Oh. Bye, Rich. Oh, no, don't do it.
Peggy in Chicago.
Oh, you did.
I have a different point of view.
Okay.
I think that when Will Smith did this, maybe he wasn't speaking for himself, but for us who cannot speak. We are the ghosts, people that have no voice. We are the people
who have no voice and want to slap Chris Rock?
We have no voice in the Oscars. They've changed.
Not part of the Academy. Yeah.
And we don't have the ability to say, stop. Stop this.
Stop.
He was the only one there who could say it.
Stop making Power the Dog.
I don't think he was speaking for himself. I think he was speaking for us.
What is it he's stopping? What is he saying, stop this on our behalf?
What he's saying is that what you're doing, the values that you have, are not the ones we want to see at the Oscars. Do you remember what it was like 50, 60 years ago?
No.
Do you remember the jokes that they told? Do you remember what they did, the kind of people they were? Things have changed. People don't watch the Oscars because there's nothing there.
Well,
and someone needed to stand up and say and speak for us.
Hey, Peggy, Will Smith's life that is now completely open to the public, is that an example of the golden era of Hollywood?
She certainly is not. But if you didn't know that and you said, God, I wish there was somebody who would tell them that we don't want this. We want what we had, and we don't have it anymore, and we'd like to have it back, thank you. And Chris Rock is somebody that's current.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Peggy. Here's what I would say, too. The way that celebrity was covered 50 years ago is very different. But, you know, the good old days weren't all that good when it came to people who chose to pursue fame over God. It's no different 50, 100, 1,000 years ago than it is today.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Well, as is customary, at the Oscars on Sunday night, you had some piglets on stage repeating the tropes of the left when it came to current topics like the anti-indoctrination legislation, really the parents' rights legislation
that they say is the Don't Say Gay bill.
Is pending in Florida and is now being replicated in other states, such that gender ideology shall not be part of the curriculum in pre-K through third grade. We're not going to sexualize children in pre-K through third grade in Florida, say Florida Republicans, including Governor DeSantis, and this has been met with the expected hysteria. And so yesterday was a momentous day because in spite of opposition from Disney and other corporate cowards, in spite of the public ridicule of the Hollywood elites, which is an oxymoron, Hollywood elite, Ron DeSantis signed that bill yesterday and had a message for Disney and the cultural mavens.
There's been a lot of discussions about this particular piece of legislation. You've seen a lot of sloganeering and fake narratives by leftist politicians, by activists, by corporate media, and you still see it even today after a lot of this stuff has been debunked. Now, it's true, many of the people who whipped this up have never actually read the bill. They haven't taken the time to do that. They would rather just further narratives. But I must tell you, these leftist politicians, corporate media outlets, some of these activist groups, they actually have read the bill. And they're sloganeering because they don't want to admit that they support a lot of the things that we're providing protections against. For example, they support sexualizing kids in kindergarten. They support injecting woke gender ideology into second grade classrooms. They support enabling schools to, quote, transition students to a, quote, different gender without the knowledge of the parent, much less without the parent's consent. And so what they're doing with these slogans and these narratives is they are trying to camouflage their true intentions. They know in every single poll that's been done that actually reads the language in the bill will find overwhelmingly Americans oppose injecting this type of material into the classroom of young kids. Americans support the right of parents to be informed and to be able to withhold consent over certain types of medical treatments in school. So they know that, and so that's why they're resorting to some of the narratives. And it hasn't worked, but let's just be clear. It's not just all of them have not read the bill. Many have not. Many have, and many of them want to see this type of stuff in our schools. I don't care what corporate media outlets say. I don't care what Hollywood says. I don't care what big corporations say. Here I stand. I'm not backing down.
I hope you were listening. That's how you do it.
That's how we do it.
Did he and his wife and his kids tweet that out afterwards?
DeSantis then went on to say, DC press corps, corporate elites, corporate media.
Yeah.
Get my wife's name out your mouth.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. This is why I am so high on DeSantis, is because he's the explainer-in-chief there in Florida. Here's what they're doing. Here's what the legislation says. Here's what my opposition is saying about it. Here's what my opposition is doing. Some are willfully blind and, you know, blissfully ignorant. Haven't read it, not going to read it, may not know how to read. Others have read it, and they're liars. He said narrative. Let's even be more direct. They're liars. This is what they want. They know what's in it. They know what they're saying is in it, is not in it. They are liars. And why would you cast your lot with liars? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text. And you want to win the fight at the local level, school board by and school district by school district? Well, this is how you do it when you live in a state like Illinois, where you don't have any support over the top in your legislative body or your governor's mansion. You approach it exactly how DeSantis and Florida Republicans approach this in the Sunshine State. That's how you do it. And I know there are parents doing it at the local level here. Actually, we recently got a communique from one. And I haven't talked to her. I've just got the email, so I won't give her name. But she's a member of a local parent group in Antioch that she writes is growing quickly and gathering more and more in neighboring school districts to fight the woke curriculum and the materials that are being introduced in schools. Original name was Parents and Antioch Community Committee, and they're thinking about a name change. They've talked to Frank McCormick, who we've talked on the show, the history teacher from Waukegan High School.
Oh, yeah.
Who, but for tenure, would be out on his ear because he's opposed to the woke curriculum at the high school level. She writes, "We've been fighting against pornography that was discovered in our schools, and we have not yet won the debate, but they're putting in the fight. And what's the example that she gives in this email to us? A book we've been talking about quite a bit, Genderqueer. You had a fight over this book in Downers Grove.
Oh,
we
yeah.
played clips from the school boards there. And
I read it. It's disgusting.
At New Trier.
Absolutely sickening.
Yeah, New Trier, you've had parents read passages. New Trier High School, you had parents read passages out loud.
And they stopped them because it was too grotesque. And yes. There's kids. Remember, they stopped them and said, well, there's kids in the room. Well, you want kids to read this book. Wake up.
They've done. We see the same thing. I mean, this is all over the country. We played, I believe it was somewhere in Northern California. Same deal, same book. And that's just one of the books. It's just like How to Be an Anti-Racist. Ibram Kendi, Don't Call Me Henry Rogers' Racist Screed is just one of the books. Robin DiAngelo's Wife Fragility, just one of the books. But it's the same books pushing the same ideology by the same indoctrinators, no matter where you go. And, you know, because Glenn Youngkin won in Virginia, because Ron DeSantis and Florida Republicans have made their parents' rights bill the law down there, you know, that doesn't mean the fight is over even in those states, much less states like Illinois. And, by the way, speaking of Illinois, and at the federal level, to try to rein in these rogue states like Florida, a very own Congress being, Brad Schneider.
That guy's still around?
Yeah.
He's quiet like a church mouse. And he rides his bike with his mom jeans on and his helmet. He's his congressional district.
Cardboard cutout, male impersonator.
He is
perfect.
White toast. I mean, oh my God.
He is the perfect.
He goes along to get along.
Cant spewing politician that we love. He introduced legislation. Don't block LGBTQ. What about the IA? Act of 2020 would clarify that schools and libraries that block LGBTQ. Where's the IA? Resources are not eligible for discounted rates right. under the E-rate program. But, you know, again, the courageous stand of a Brad Schneider. The point is to say the sort of virtue signaling in legislative form in opposition to parents groups like this one in Antioch I'm referencing. And in support of those who would give you a drag queen story hour for third graders and all of the decks, the PowerPoints that we've gone through from Evanston Skokie, from New Trier, from Lyons Township, from everywhere. Naperville. Everywhere. Hinsdale. So, you know, the DeSantis victory because of the choices that Floridians have made as to the composition of their legislature and the occupant of their governor's mansion is a big one. And it's no smaller than Glenn Youngkin's upset victory in Virginia. To win an election, you win an election as the means to what? Policy ends. Well, here you go. You win elections like they've done in Florida, and here are your policy ends. The empowering of parents and the empowering of parents who are speaking out while being ridiculed by their school board and their administrators in places like Antioch and so many other places, as we saw. Whether it's about COVID policy or it's about curriculum, the attitude is the same and the fight at a sort of a fundamental level is the same. And so yesterday in Florida, Ron DeSantis won one for the good guys, and he provided a blueprint on how to do it.
The more you listen, the more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, speaking of gender ideology, the Babylon Bee reporting that the clownfish, Leah Thomas, is confused as to why her teammates keep asking her to open pickle jars.
Oh, you guys.
That's so good.
Can you explain that to ladies? No, I'm kidding.
That's the kind of thing that has Alex Primetime Stein up in arms.
Is he back?
He's back, and he wants to swim with the ladies. And there's no reason, as per the arguments made on behalf of Leah Thomas and against Ron DeSantis' parents' Bill of Rights, that he shouldn't, Alex Primetime Stein addressing the Plano, Texas City Council about collegiate swimming for some reason because he can.
What he's wearing? Tell him what he's wearing.
He's wearing a one piece.
Oh my God.
With a swimming cap and goggles.
Oh, I just got the chills. Oh,
and offering this commentary.
Oh boy.
But you guys are going to sit here and you're not going to take me seriously. You're going to laugh at me. I'm trying to compete. And yes, I was born a boy. So what, guys? This is 2022. It doesn't matter what you're born. We have Kentaji Brown Jackson even says she doesn't even know what a woman is. So then I'm a woman. So that's what you guys have to do. If the Supreme Court justice is on my side, then why can't I get the same from the Plano City Council? That's the problem, is I come here and I'm still a victim of transphobia. Yet we have champions like my girl Leah, my sister, and she gets to win, but I don't. Why not? That's what I'm asking you. Why not? Why can't I swim against the ladies? Why are we having a transphobic world where I just want to compete against the ladies? Why are you saying that I'm not a biological woman? Clearly, I look like a biological woman. Mm. I mean, come on. It's been hours tucking this thing in. Give me a break. I should be able to swim. And I'm on so much hormone therapy, I don't even know left or right anymore. So I'm doing this. I don't have an unfair advantage. No way. So I need you guys to stand up. We have a city issue, Rick, and we can actually fix this. And let me compete against the ladies.
On,
I'm sick of these women. Same. Oh, you're having an unfair advantage. Yeah, right. And I'm mentally ill, and they won't even let me compete in the Special Olympics. So go figure. Think about that. I can't compete in the Special Olympics, and I can't compete against women. What kind of bigotry is that? Are you guys going to let that stand? I wouldn't let that stand. If I were y'all, I would stand up for me, because in the future, they're going to write these in the history books, and you're going to have to decide what side Plano was on. Were they transphobes? Or were they trans positive? And obviously, I'm trans positive. So that's what I want. I want you guys to wake up to what's going on in the world and tell the City of Plano Swim League to let me compete against the ladies. I've been on hormone blockers for nearly 2 weeks now. And like I said, I'm so messed up from them, I'm probably going to lose anyway. But I can send that tape to a college and I might get a scholarship, Julie. So don't look at me with your eyes looking at me all mean. I'm out here trying to change for you. This is women's rights. I'm standing up for women's rights. Thank you. It's Primetime Stein on Instagram if you guys want to learn how to swim against the ladies. Thank you all so much. Oh my
God. Yeah, I mean, I guess if Leah can swim for Penn, then it seems only fitting that Primetime Stein could swim for the Plano, Texas Women's Swim League at the local YWCA or something.
His bathing suit is something my grandma used to wear. I mean,
It's very tasteful. It's not very aerodynamic, but it is very tasteful.
Wow.
I don't.
He let it all hang. I mean, he let it show, like the eyes, the legs. He was in the swimsuit.
Well, I mean, I think that's, you know, he's trying to work his way up through the local leagues to the collegiate level because he probably needs to. Slim down a little bit. I don't know that he's ready for.
Yeah, he needs to work
100 meter dashes and so forth. Yeah. But it's aspirational. And look at all that he's putting himself through in order to get there. Oh, by the way, speaking of KBJ, since he spoke about Ketanji Brown Jackson and her confusion or inability, I don't know if she's confused or not.
To describe what a woman is.
To define.
Or define, excuse me.
Yeah. We also find that, you know, her whole, like, I don't know what... this critical race theory you speak of, it's a theory taught in law school, and I don't have any role in the curriculum at Georgetown Day School. Remember her exchanges with Ted Cruz last week where he went through what Georgetown Day School, where she's a board member, is instructing the children, what they're providing in terms of instruction on this topic, and she sort of was, you know, that's not something I pay much attention to. It has nothing to do with my job as a judge. I don't really know what's going on. All
right.
That.
Mm-hmm. Plausible deniability.
That she was actually involved in the drafting of the anti-racist agreement that all parents of children at Georgetown Day School must sign for enrollment.
Oh.
Yeah. So that means that she, you know, effectively, this isn't like perjurious, but effectively lied under oath. The forum, Parents Acknowledge and Understand that GDS is an institution that values diversity, equity, and inclusion, has made a commitment to work actively against individual systemic racism, hatred, and oppression, bigotry of any kind. By signing this document, parents, students agree to join the school's commitment to engage in actions and efforts in furtherance of these values and commitments within the GDS community. That's all boilerplate, anti-racist, critical race theory lingo. She knows it. She knows the Ibram Kendi books that are part of the curriculum, and she lied about knowing what she knows. She pretended to be unsophisticated about what's happening when she is sophisticated about what's happening. And that's, frankly, reason enough to vote against her if you needed more evidence than you got from the Q&A between her and Blackburn, between her and Cruz, between her and Howley on the other issues that were covered. The lack of forthrightness on this topic, if this is something that's important to you, if this is something that you think is worthwhile, particularly when it comes to the education of young people, then be out and proud about it. And she wasn't. She lied. We'll see. Maybe Manchin can change his mind. I doubt it, though.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. America First with Sebastian Gorka. Today at 3, right before Sean Thompson at 4 on AM560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So Joe Biden fielded some questions from the D.C. press corps yesterday, and fortunately that gave him time, waiting till Monday, to have his team script some answers for him so that he didn't...
I saw what you were talking about.
So he didn't commit to things that are actually adverse to his administration stated policies, like regime change. He didn't walk back anything, he said, but he did clarify the things that he didn't walk back.
Are you worried that other leaders in the world are going to start to doubt that America is back if some of these big things that you say on the world stage keep getting walked back?
What's getting walked back?
It made it sound like, just in the last couple days, it sounded like you told U.S. troops they were going to Ukraine. It sounded like you said it was possible the U.S. would use a chemical weapon, and it sounded like you were calling for regime change in Russia, and we know...
None of the three.
Mr. President?
You interpret the language that way. I was talking to the troops. We're talking about helping train the troops the Ukrainian troops that are in Poland. That's what the context. I sat there with those guys for a couple hours. That's what we talked about.
So when you said you're going to see when you're there... You were not intending to...
I was referring to meeting with and talking with the Ukrainian troops who were in Poland.
And when you said a chemical weapon use by Russia would trigger a response in kind?
It will trigger a significant response.
What does that mean?
I'm not going to tell you. Why would I tell you? You got to be silly.
The world wants to know?
The world wants to know a lot of things. I'm not telling them what the response would be. Then Russia knows the response.
Well, the world would like to know something else. Ducey missed this one. So you're talking about the 82nd Airborne. You're talking about training Ukrainian troops in Poland. Are the Russians in Poland, Mr. President, because you mentioned in your comments you're going to see things like the people, Ukrainians, standing in front of Russian tanks. You're going to bear witness to essentially the atrocities of Vlad Putin. Well, how are you going to do that if you're not in Ukraine? All kinds of questions for the big guy. For more on all this, pleased to be joined by Nadia Shadlow. She's a fellow at the Hoover Institution and the Hudson Institute. Nadia, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Dan and Amy. Happy to be here.
The president didn't walk back, but he did clarify the misinterpretations that people who understand the English language have about what he said over the last 3 weeks.
I think there's a lot of confusion out there. which, you know, in some ways can be helpful sometimes, but not all the time. Deterrence is a mixture of will and capability, and sort of broadcasting what we will or won't do. I think it takes it's a delicate balance, which I'm not sure we've achieved.
Well, he said he was declaring moral outrage, not regime change. But yet Blinken and others, you know, they were doing cleanup for 48 hours straight.
Yeah, I think he certainly misspoke. You know, clearly he misspoke. Clearly, the last thing we want to do is project. Is be talking about regime change.
Well, I mean,
in that context.
Yeah, I mean, did he misspeak or was it just an excited utterance? Maybe that is his actual position. It's hard to know. And the confusion you talk about that has a deterrent effect, that's supposed to be when you're instilling confusion in your adversary, not when you're confused.
Yeah, exactly. I think there's been part of the problem has been not figuring out who the audience is, right? So I'd written a piece last week on this concept of deterrence, not my concept. It's a well-known strategic concept that has existed, you know, for centuries. It's a mixture of will and capability. You have the will to do something and you broadcast that will, but you also have the capability, meaning the military force, to back it up. We certainly have a lot of capabilities, but early on in this crisis, the White House failed to really articulate our will. That does not mean that we would actually deploy troops to Ukraine, right? There's a difference, but saying what we won't do all the time since December, saying we will not do this, we will not do that, you sort of undercut the value of deterrence. Right. December, January, February, constant statements of what we would not do, which sends the wrong signal at that time to Putin.
Like the minor incursion incident.
Right. In December, it was no troops. It was we will be, we would allow a minor incursion. In February, it was a consistent discussion of what we would not do. We had no intention of fighting Russia. Now, These might be the right policies internally, deliberations, but you do not want to broadcast to your adversaries your thinking and your options. You want to create complexity for the adversary. You want to keep your options open.
What is your assessment of how Zelensky has been playing the game, if you will? On the one hand, he telegraphs that Ukraine, reportedly he telegraphed Ukraine, is willing to go to neutrality, and that requires more definition, but essentially that would be we're not going to ally with NATO, we're not going to pursue NATO, as well as give up any interest in nuclear weapons in order for an armistice. But then at the same time, he also demands that Putin meet him face-to-face in order for a peace agreement to be hammered out, something that Putin said he wouldn't do. How do you think he's been moving chess pieces about the board?
Right. Well, I think his dilemma is different. You can't apply every formula in the exact same way, but he's in a different situation. So as he approaches, he wants to express a willingness to say, look, we're willing to come to the table. And that's appropriate because that's what he's messaging. He's sending out a whole range of options, probably, I would say, to indicate that there's some flexibility in there. I think he actually cares about his country. He wants it to be rebuilt, not destroyed. He wants Ukrainians to come home, not to stay away. So I think, I think he's willing to show some flexibility in what a negotiated solution should look like. He's been brilliant at curating his messages to different audiences, to the U.S. Congress, to different parliaments around Europe. I mean, clearly he's a charismatic, brilliant leader. He's been unfortunately he found himself in the right place at the right time. So I think his job is different than Biden's job as this war unfolded, right? They had a different message that they needed to convey, and Zelensky understands that.
Does the Biden administration, starting with the big guy, just have a fundamental misunderstanding of the world and the geopolitical challenges it presents? And for that, I reference this piece by our friend Jacob Griegel, who's a professor at Catholic University.
He's a great friend of mine, by the way.
Oh, okay, yeah. Good. Yeah. All right. Well, let's see if you're still friends after you respond to this. He wrote the Biden administration has been vocal in defending what it calls the rules-based international order, but there's no such thing. An earth-spanning security space governed by global rules or a few key powers doesn't exist, and the war in Ukraine should remind us. There's also no global threat facing all states equally, but rather regional revisionist powers threatening nearby states. Temporary regional equilibria with their own power dynamics are driven by local historical competitions. They are unstable and prone to wars. they require persistent attention and management rather than this utopian idea. There's a rules-based international order. Understand there are regional power centers and conflicts, and they need to be dealt with delicately and within that context. That's a much different understanding of the world than the one the Biden administration is projecting.
Yeah, I mean, not surprisingly, I completely agree with Jakob. There are no global solutions to problems, right? Problems occur, the solutions to problems begin at the local level. And then move up. There's no global governance, thank goodness, and there are really no global institutions that have effective operational capabilities. That means that states provide institutions with money, with resources, with people, even. So what? So that's one key important point that Jakob has made. A second is that. The regional problems are different, right? You have a different set of problems in Europe than you do in Asia, than you might in Latin America, than Africa. So working on those problem sets in a regional capacity gives you a better chance to actually get to outcomes that you want, right? Get to solutions that you want. The Biden administration's approach, but it's not just his approach, I think this is a general divide between the left and the right, is to pursue activities first and foremost through multilateral organizations, as opposed to looking at what can be done at the more local or state level, right? There's sort of a belief that these organizations that are really best suited for communication, for talking, as opposed to doing.
Yeah, central planners will centrally plan.
Right.
I mean, it's sort of a central
right.
planner's vision of the world, as opposed to, you know, the small D Democrat who believes in subsidiarity.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
I wanted to get to your intuition on this as well. Abramovich is one of the oligarchs that Zelensky asked the Biden administration not to impose sanctions on because he thought Abramovich could be useful in brokering peace between Russia and Ukraine. Now there's a report out that Abramovich, as he was bouncing around Ukraine and Belarus and Russia, could have been poisoned, as well as other Ukrainian peace negotiators. That's sort of an old go-to of Putin. And what does that say about Putin's interest in any serious interest in peace if that report turns out to be accurate?
I mean, I'm just conjecture like everyone else, but it sends a pretty alarming, disturbing signal, right, that he really is not interested in trying to find a negotiated solution if he's ready to poison, you know, one of someone who purportedly was a friend of his, right? It sends a sense of Putin just wants to you know, send fear out. He wants to imbue everyone around him with fear. I think that's pretty clear, and possibly the negotiators as well. It's not beyond him to do this, right? It's too bad that they couldn't be tested at the right time to actually make a clear determination of what happened. But he certainly wants to send fear. It's certainly the opposite of Zelensky, who seems to be projecting a sense of openness toward a negotiated solution because he cares about lives.
Do you fear that Putin's going to use chemical weapons? And as Biden says, will we respond in kind?
Yeah, I think Biden misspoke clearly, and you know he was corrected about that. Right, it sounded very much like we would respond with chemical weapons, which I agree. yeah. But I think Putin, you know, who knows? Putin can certainly. He basically de facto has. I mean, in Syria, the Russians were key supporters of the Assad regime that used chlorine gas against Syrian citizens. So the record is there, and you know, hopefully, I mean, obviously, it would be a catastrophe if he did that.
And with respect to the escalation here, the response from the West, you know, not telegraphed, but as we're talking about it here, thinking strategically, you know, what should it be at this point? Is setting the rhetoric aside, is all we should do and really can do to help chart Ukraine's course, to help them in charting their own course, is to provide these weapon systems that have been provided. Is there anything else obvious that we're missing that would not escalate the situation?
I don't think there's anything obvious. Maybe there's more use of cyber capabilities and things that we could be doing sort of in that world. More weapons of different kinds. There really aren't defensive or offensive weapons in some ways in this case. I mean, Ukraine is using them defensively. They're protecting, right? They're protecting their territory. They're protecting their people. Their mission is defensive. But there are longer term things that we need to do that this crisis has shown us, right? We need to go back to a sensible energy policy that puts the United States at the center of that solution. Right, where we had energy independence under the previous administration, and moving away from that is crazy and does not make strategic sense. We need to, develop policies that allow, brain drain really from Russia, right? Encourage Russian scientists and tech people to come to the United States. So there are longer term policies. I mean, not right now for that, but over the longer term, we need to watch China's role in this situation and ensure that China doesn't become sort of the global arbiter of this, which, China's trying to position itself now to mediate. So there are some longer term policies, but in the near term, and also reaffirm our commitment to NATO and continue to send different types of weapons to Ukraine quickly, and hopefully work behind the scenes to move toward a negotiated solution that preserves Ukrainian sovereignty.
Well, and we seem to be at cross purposes, at least according to our friend Jim Carafano at the Heritage Foundation, who was very concerned about this Iran nuclear deal that may be inked soon, that he suggested gives Russia a backdoor to avoid sanctions. So that doesn't make much sense. And also suggested, because of the glide path it could provide Iran to nuclear weapons, could instigate a regional war in the Middle East with an Israeli response to such a weapons program. What's your view on that?
I mean, I think Jim's exactly right. I mean, I should have also mentioned, to your point about a backdoor for Russian oil and gas. Europe is still buying Russian gas and oil right now. There's something like $1 billion a day going into Russia, which I was shocked to find. I mean, I don't understand it. So there are still apertures that we could be closing and should be closing, right? So Jim is exactly right. We are sitting next to the Russians at the table to negotiate one of the most important agreements that the Biden administration is wedded to. I mean, I don't think it's a good agreement at all. But the fact that we're still sitting with Russia at the table sort of as an equal negotiator while we're watching what's happening in Europe is a complete disconnect. It makes no sense.
She is Nadia Shadlow, fellow at the Hoover Institution and the Hudson Institute. Nadia, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, former President Donald Trump, remember him?
I'm very familiar with his work.
He's enjoying life down there in Florida, at least some of the time.
He did something you and I both have done.
That's right. And I don't know if this was his first one or not, but here it goes.
President made a hole-in-one. 180-yard 5-iron.
That Florida wind sometimes is cumbersome.
Yeah, it's windy out there.
It's there. That's great.
There it is.
That's great. Thank you.
The guys want a picture with you.
Let's get a picture. You don't see that.
Yeah, you don't see that.
Get a picture, little guy.
That's awesome.
Get right here, squiggly right here.
And he had witnesses there. He's playing with three guys, so it was videoed,
the mainstream media thought it was fake news. Right. Like Kim Jong-un's father when he went golfing for the first time ever and got 12 holes in one. Remember that?
Yeah, not quite. But he's making golf great again.
Okay, good.
President Trump.
Congratulations.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. I know that raising the specter of election rigging or voter fraud means imperiling our democracy, according to the hysterics on the left. But we're going to do it anyway.
It means we might get taken off YouTube again.
We're going to do it anyway because our friend John Lott has some new research I want him to unfurl for us as well as our listeners. John Lott is the president of the Crime Prevention Research Center. He's a former senior advisor for research and statistics at the U.S. Department of Justice's Office of Legal Policy. He's the author of books including Gun Control Myths and More Guns, Less Crime. So what does that have to do with voter fraud? Well, he's a statistician. And econometrics have a lot to do with assessing whether there are voting irregularities. John Lott, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
It's great to talk to you guys.
So you point out in your piece that by the way, a lot of Americans are concerned about this, including a lot of self-described Democrats concerned about free and fair elections that are on the up and up. And so this research like you've done is something that may not be of interest to the D.C. press corps, but is of interest to actual civic-minded Americans. What is this new research that you've done on excess votes?
Right. I have a paper that's been accepted by an academic journal, Public Choice, and it's research that I started when I was at the Department of Justice. My estimate is that in six swing states, you're talking about 255,000 problematic votes for Biden, maybe as high as 367,000. There are three different types of tests that I have in this paper. One is looking at precincts that are across the street from each other in different counties, where one precinct's in a county where fraud was alleged, and the other one in it's a precinct in the county where there was no allegations of fraud. And you have to understand, these precincts are very tiny areas. In Allegheny County, which is Pittsburgh in Pennsylvania, for example, they have 1,323 precincts there. So you're talking about small, homogeneous areas that are just across the street from each other. And you have information for the 2016 election and the 2020 election. What you find is that the share of the vote that the presidential candidates got in the 2016 election, the in-precinct, in-person votes, matched very well how the two different precincts came out in terms of the absentee ballots. You don't find that in the 2020 election. They still match up in terms of the in-precinct votes, but just going across the street causes you to see a much higher voting turnout for Biden in the precinct where the county where fraud was alleged than you saw in the neighboring precinct.
Now let's stop there for a second. So let's explore this first piece. So are there plausible explanations for that? Like I'll use a Chicago example. This isn't perfect, but it makes it local. Hinsdale is a village that's mostly in DuPage County, but it's got a little portion in Cook. So let's say that Hinsdale's demographics were different than they actually are. And the portion in Cook was a population that is more inclined to vote Democrat, and the population in DuPage on the other side was more inclined to vote Republican. And what you saw was, because of the ease of the all-mail-in election, more people voted on that small side of Hinsdale in the Cook County portion than normally would have if not for the ease of voting absentee.
Right. Well,
is that possible?
Well, I mean, you don't see the gap at all when you look at the difference in the 2016 election. Okay.
Well, I know, but I mean, just but I know it's different than 2016, but you have to factor in the mail-in balloting, right?
Yeah, no, I understand. Well, the thing is, you know, there's no evidence in Pennsylvania or Georgia where we looked at this, that there was, I mean, these are statewide elections mm-hmm. that they're trying to win here. There's no evidence that they tried to get a higher turnout in terms of absentee ballots. These are two very similar precincts. You don't have, you know, I can control for voter registration. I can control for demographics, you know, income and race and gender that's there for the people that are there. You know, you control for whether it's a Democratic area or not. First of all, you see very little differences normally on average between two precincts that are across the street from each other in terms of how they vote.
Mm-hmm.
In any given year, there tend to be about equally Republican and Democrat. I mean, you drive across most county lines, you're in a residential area and you drive across the county line there, the street, you're probably not going to see big differences there. And it's not, you know, you look at the data here and they're very similar places. It's not like one place is heavily Democrat and when you drive across the street, it's heavily Republican.
Which is why, by the way, you know, there's so much interest in both parties in gerrymandering, and you have all these very creative districts because of what you're saying is the case, just generally speaking, about the about the clusters of voters.
Yeah, they don't just go and keep things purely within a county line or something like that. They go all over the place on those things for precisely the point that you're making. And so you can compare these places and you just don't see, you know, the place that just happens to be across the street being incredibly Democrat or much different, really. I mean, you're talking about, you know, a percentage point or two difference in terms of the composition of the voter registration between the places on average. And yet, when you look at the absentee ballots, you're talking about 20, 25, 30% gaps that appear in terms of how they vote in terms of absentee ballots, even after you take into account, you know, the absentee ballots in the neighboring precinct, and you take into account the in-person voting in both precincts.
And did we change the way we did these elections because of COVID?
Right. Well, we did in many places. The issue was often how the changes were made, whether they were made by the legislature as supposed to be done by the Constitution, or whether they were done by courts, or whether they were done by the Secretary of States in different states without having legislation there to approve it. You know, you go and you look at these cases that go before the courts. What happens is that, you know, you would think that, you know, they got into the minutiae of whether or not fraud had occurred in these races. And that's not what happened. What happened was the Republicans would go and say, look, there's lots of irregularities here that have occurred. The courts would very frequently agree that irregularities had occurred. But they would say, look, you have to provide us with evidence that there's enough fraud that would have changed the outcome of the election. And the Republicans would respond by saying, well, you have to grant us discovery because we weren't allowed to go and watch the proceedings as we were supposed to here to go and count the votes that were being counted. And the courts would say, we're not going to grant you discovery until you provide us with sufficient evidence that there was enough irregularities to change the outcome of the elections. And so the Republicans, in case after case, were kind of stuck with a catch-22 type situation.
So focusing on these precincts, similar precincts, neighboring counties, and the absentee ballot gaps. For example, you write, just in Fulton County, Georgia, my test yielded an unexplained 70,000 votes, 32% more than Biden's margin over Trump in the entire state, 70,000 votes in Fulton County. Seems to me now, again, this is just recently research you've concluded, but it seems to me that this is something where you then say, OK, well, I don't know if that would have changed the election, but we know there's this gap and it's unusual. Now we go explore those absentee ballots in, say, Fulton County, Georgia, and see what we can ascertain. Is that, I mean, again, we're not talking about a 2020 election challenge. We're talking about this theoretically, but that's something that you would want to do on a go forward basis to ensure the integrity of the process.
Right. Look, I'm not trying to relitigate the 2020 election. My concern, and I try to make this clear in my writing, my concern is going forward. You know, you have, as you mentioned, large percentages of the population who, even Democrats, I mean, there are surveys that indicate that 34% of Democrats think the outcome of the 2020 election was affected by voting fraud type issues. That's a huge percentage of even Democrats. I mean, despite the need, you know, and whether it's true or not, you know, people have these concerns. My evidence indicates that, in fact, there were real problems that were occurring there. And you know, I hope people will at least examine why these irregularities occurred. You know, look, the United States is an extreme outlier compared to virtually the entire world in terms of how we deal with vote integrity. So, for example, you look at Europe, there are 47 countries in Europe, 46 and a half of the countries in Europe require government-issued photo IDs to be able to go and vote. The one holdout is part of the UK, but even now they're moving to change it, so pretty soon it'll be all of Europe. The same is true with developed countries around the world. You look at absentee ballots. 35 of the 47 countries in Europe ban absentee ballots because of concerns about fraud. Another 10 allow absentee ballots, but you have to go and pick up the ballot yourself. They would not put it in the mail because they're worried about it being stolen. And you have to show your government-issued photo ID when you go and you pick up your absentee ballot. There's only two countries in Europe that have rules that are even close to what we have here in the United States with regard to absentee ballots, but even they have more restrictions. And so, you know, people forget kind of the history of voting in the United States. There was a period of time where vote buying was very widespread, and we banned absentee ballots for a long time. It's not until you get to the 1960s and 1970s that the rules for absentee ballots began to change as people's memories about vote buying in the past faded. But, you know, up until 1880, no state in the United States had secret ballots. And the last state to adopt secret ballots was 1950. And when states moved to secret ballots, there was about a 12 percentage point drop in voter turnout from about 62% down to 50%. Well, why? Why do you have such a huge drop in voter turnout when we went to secret ballots? The reason was that people weren't getting paid anymore. You know, it used to be that you'd have a ballot box up in the front of the room, and people would take colored pieces of paper and they drop them in the ballot box, and the representatives for the parties would be standing on either side of the ballot box, and they could see what colored paper you were putting in the ballot box. And then they would pay you based on whether or not you voted for them or not. Oh, and, you know, the problem was when you went to secret ballots, they couldn't, you know, you could tell them how you voted, but they couldn't be sure. So they stopped paying. And that's the reason why we banned absentee ballots largely in the United States, because we wanted to make sure that there wasn't vote buying. Because if you have absentee ballots, you could go and show somebody how you voted, and they could guarantee it. In fact, that's the other reason why ballot harvesting.
Well, right, and why so many states moved to prohibit that in the wake of 2020, the ballot harvesting issue.
Right, but I'm just saying that was where the original ballot harvesting rules came from, was our past history. But people don't seem to remember the voting history in the United States.
So we all know that, you know, voter fraud erodes trust in elections. Will anything be different for the midterms here?
Well, I mean, you have some states that are changing, and they're, you know, look at the debate that's been occurring over that with Georgia, for example, with all these companies being outraged. What Georgia's rule that got everybody upset was is that on the absentee ballots, they're requiring that you put down the last four digits of your Social Security number. Everybody has a Social Security number. Many non-citizens have Social Security numbers. When you're checking signatures, and on average, I guess like 5 seconds is spent to check a signature, actually using the last four, and blacks have had their signatures disproportionately disallowed when they've done the checking. This last election, a lot of states didn't even check signatures, didn't even try. But with the last four digits of your Social Security number, which caused such outrage, you know, there you get around that problem. You don't have to worry about discriminating against blacks disproportionately. You look at the rest of the world where they're requiring photo IDs to be able to go and pick up absentee ballots that you have to do in person, and having the last four digits on your Social Security number on something that they mail you seems pretty minor.
I want to get to another category of votes you looked at. We talked about absentee ballot vote disparity. You also looked at provisional ballots in Allegheny County, Pennsylvania. What did you find?
Right. Well, one of the allegations that occurred was that when somebody filled out their absentee ballots improperly, the Democratic counties in Pennsylvania would send people a provisional ballot and ask them to correct the mistake so that their vote could be counted. None of the Republican counties did that, or at least had allegations that they had done that. And the problem is, it was against state law for them to do that. And what you found, so what I wanted to look at was to see, is there evidence that in fact you had a disproportionate rate of provisional ballots being issued in Allegheny County relative to these precincts that are across the street from them? And, you know, did that get more votes for Biden? In fact, you find substantial evidence, very significant evidence, in fact, that that was the case, that the precincts across the street had a lot more provisional ballots, and they were, you know, very heavily for Biden.
And then you also looked at voter turnout and where it was unusually large and more normal or even less than it was in 2016. And what did that tell you?
Right. So I looked at the 10 swing states, and what you found is that more heavily Democratic counties actually had a lower turnout in 2020 compared to 2016, except for the counties where fraud was alleged. And in those counties, you had huge increases in turnout. I mean, you're talking about 25-30% increases in turnout relative to what they had had in 2016. So, I mean, you could look at counties in Ohio, for example, like Franklin, which is Columbus, or you could look at the county for Cleveland or Cincinnati. That's a swing state. Those counties actually saw drops in turnout in 2020 relative to 2016, but in Allegheny County or Philadelphia or in Fulton County in Georgia, you saw big increases in turnout. And, you know, one of the possibilities there, I don't think this is quite as strong as the other evidence that I have there, but is that you have a lot more ineligible people voting. You know, why is it that urban, heavily Democratic counties and swing states that where fraud wasn't alleged actually saw a small drop in turnout, but in the counties where fraud was alleged, you saw huge increases in turnout?
It seems to me, too, with like your research where you start to zero in on some of these counties or even doing the precinct comparison you were describing. Now, these election authorities all have recorded who has voted, or who voted, I should say, in 2020 and who did not. And so it seems to me now you could take what you're suggesting in terms of a roadmap and look at the actual voter files to say who they say voted versus who didn't, and really go door to door with the voter rolls saying, did you vote or did you not vote, and perhaps compile real evidence that would add to this case prospectively making elections more secure.
You're exactly right, and you would think that would be a simple thing to do, and it's actually something I've been working on for the last 6 months. But what I found is that virtually none of the counties in the country keep an actual list of who voted. They're supposed to keep this data for 22 months, but I kid you not, but it looks like about 98-99% of the counties don't keep that list. Because what I wanted to do was just to compare in a very simple way. I thought this was trivial. I thought this would be very easy to do. Just compare the number of votes counted by precinct with the number of people who are listed as voting. But what happens is that these counties and the state secretaries of state are constantly updating and saving over the files that they had. So they can just say, well, you know, we have new people registered. We have people who died. We have people who moved. We can tell you the current list, but we can't tell you the actual list of people who voted on November 3rd, 2020. For the few places where they actually tell you that they did keep the original list, what you find is that it doesn't match. The number of people who vote in a precinct don't match the number of ballots cast. And, you know, you're talking about like a 2% gap there, but it's not even possible to do that very simple test for the majority of counties in the country. And, you know, more will be coming out about that in the near future, I think.
Well, we'll look forward to more when it comes out. John Lott, president of the Crime Prevention Research Center, former senior advisor for research and statistics at the U.S. Department of Justice's Office of Legal Policy, and author of Gun Control Myths and More Guns, Less Crime. John, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you for being there.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Insert Democrat socialist here.
Runs the Democratic House law for 30-plus years running. He's promising this and he's stealing that. Where can you get that kind of money? He's using your house like his own piggy bank. You ought to know by now. You can pay off your house here in Illinois, but you can never keep up with the taxes. Oh, how it's always been the plan to have a taxpayer pay no doubt. Not a matter of if anymore, but when. You're moving out.
Dan and Amy, that theme music means it's time for a weekly confab with Ted Dabrowski, president of WirePoints.com, all things Illinois policy related. But before we get to Ted, I know there was some Republican criticism of one Governor Spaulding when the story came out that the trust that manages his money, you know,
the Pritzker Group,
the trust managers,
yeah,
you know, he put all his current investments into
right.
a trust.
Well, he doesn't have any idea how it's being spent.
No idea.
I mean, I'm sure he doesn't talk to anybody in his investment group.
Well, Roner did the same thing.
I know.
So let's not, you know, get crazy here. Illinois gave $2.6 billion worth of Medicaid contracts to Centene Corp. Each year, Pritzker does receive a copy of his investments from fund managers. During his 2018 campaign, he pledged to purge his investment portfolio of companies that held state contracts. However, in 2020, his portfolio managers invested in Centene Corp. Again, $2.6 billion worth of Medicaid contracts. And Pritzker could have instructed his trust managers not to invest in state contractors to eliminate the potential for a conflict of interest. Or he could have told them to divest his stake in Centene Corp because of their $2.6 billion worth of Medicaid contracts. He did neither. So he's not doing anything illegal, but he's not doing what he said he would do in the interests of good government. Right. And this is old hat. I know this is old hat in Chicago and Illinois, politicians giving contracts to campaign donors and or friends and or companies
cousins
that they have a stake in Yes, I get it. But, you know, if you're going to present yourself as charting a new course, then we have to watch what course you chart, don't we? Well, the same goes for one mayor of Aurora, recently minted Republican.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to laugh.
Richard Irvin, who's the Republican part of the Combine's choice for the Republican candidate for governor, you know, because they want to keep the situation we've had as long as I've been on the planet, which is, as Bill Cellini said, memorialized in a John Cass column, when we're in, and when they're in, we're in. We're always in. Richard Irvin is going to fight tooth and nail to bring honest and good government back to Illinois. You've probably seen his commercials. You've heard him on our airwaves. But this, according to WTTW report, was Wilmette talking to Winnetka.
Thank you.
Who knew they cared? A review of public records finds a company that donated more than $135,000 to Irvin has received millions in city contracts with the city of Aurora.
Oh, looky here.
The same company was also the beneficiary of legislation, special use permit, pushed by Irvin that could prove lucrative. The Aurora Beacon News, first reporting the story in 2018, follows a pattern of Aurora businesses donating to Irvin and receiving tens of millions in public aid and tax incentives. The company in question in this story is Scientel Solutions, which is a telecom company now based in Aurora, I should say. $3.2 million in tech and security contracts Scientel has received during Irvin's tenure for the hundreds of thousands of dollars they've given in campaign contributions to his fund and to political funds affiliated with him. Is that a problem? Or is it only a problem when Democrats do it, which has basically been the Illinois Republican Party's position also since as long as I've been on the planet, which is why the Illinois Republican Party is generally a legal fiction, and which is why I so enjoy being lectured by Combine Republicans about what it takes to win elections. Prof doesn't know how to win elections. We know how to win elections. You do? And how are we in the super minority in the Illinois House and Senate and have been for the better part of a decade? How did crime boss there, Mike Madigan from the Southwest Side, rule the roost for the last four decades? We know how to win elections. And to what ends? In the rare occasion you do with a runner, how did that advance the flag for Illinois' future those 4 years? Not to mention going back to George Ryan, Edgar, and Thompson. Anything to avoid conservative reform, that should be the Illinois Republican Party's motto. They're fraudsters. They have been. They continue to be. And Richard Irvin is their latest front man. For more on this, now we're joined by Ted Dabrowski, president of Wirepoints.com. Ted, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. Thanks for having me. I'm in lovely Florida today. This was pretty excited to be here.
Oh, good for you. And way to rub it in. People don't care where your campaign cash comes from. Pay to play is old hat here. It's passe. So, of course, you expect pay to play. So, you know, what's the big deal with respect to Pritzker's blind trust or Richard Irvin's city contracts to campaign contributors?
This is it's a big problem here, and you've covered Republicans a lot, and I from time to time things aren't nice, I've gotten phone calls, saying, "Hey Ted, come on." And I try to remind people that,
Do we need to call Scientel in Aurora to get some telecom help for you? Where
are you? Are you on your cell? Are you under a tunnel?
Get that Al Franken dish on your head.
Oh, I'm on my cell. Is it not working well?
Oh, okay.
That's
now it
better.
Is. Now it is better.
Yes. Just don't move around.
Yeah, don't move right. You're staying right there.
Not to move. Is it still okay?
Yeah, okay. All right. Now go ahead. You received calls saying, "Hey, Ted, stop being mean."
Yeah, and the thing is, I try to remind people, and people need to know, like Edgar, Edgar's the most popular Republican out there, and he did all kinds of things with these pensions. He increased benefits. He bragged about it. It's the biggest increase in 25 years. He, of course, did the pension ramp. He was as complicit as could be, and so was Thompson. So, What we need is hold both sides. Anybody, I mean, any person in Illinois should want to hold their elected officials, regardless of what party they're in, to account. And that's what we try to do. And if we don't, we end up with what we've had for the last 30, 40 years. So.
Now, have you ever reached out to Mr. Richard Ervin to see if he would talk to you in wire points?
Well, I've talked to all the candidates in detail, several times. A little less Paul Schimpf. But Richard Ervin, at this point, we haven't talked yet. So I'm not sure. We have not talked. Let's put it that way.
I wonder if he's met Keith, or what's his name? Oh, my God, the Kingmaker. Oh, my, Ken Griffith. Because he said, they haven't met each other yet, which I think was a bold-faced lie. What do you think?
No, he probably hadn't. I think they have met now. I think when he said they had met, I don't think they had met because, Ken Griffin has bigger fish to fry than whatever's happening in the Republican Party in Illinois. He made his choice based on terrible advice from Team Rahner and his gatekeeper, Kasem Carter. And then, we'll see how it plays out, see what happens on June 28th. And Ken Griffin will probably suffer more public embarrassment because of bad political advice. But we'll see. He'll either suffer that embarrassment on June 28th or he'll suffer it in November, but he's going to suffer it on one of those two dates.
Yeah, I mean, I'd love to talk to him, like all the other candidates. Happy to talk to Democrats, too. What we pursue at Wire Points is just good policy. Tax policy, we're trying to, we've reported on the out-migration. We're losing too many people. And, I don't see many of the laws that are being proposed right now on, certainly on the Democratic side, supporting keeping people here. I see some of the Republicans doing some good things, others not as good, but we still don't have the mentality of reform, compete. Look what Florida does. Look what Indiana does. We don't have to go very far, and we should copy paste.
Well, the Ervin thing too, in terms of a conversation with you. I mean, you saw how well it went for him when he talked to Flannery a few weeks back, and that was just on basic. Foundation level questions like abortion for a Republican candidate for governor. And that was too much for him to handle. So I doubt he's ready to talk about pensions. I also understand he takes one position on things like school choice publicly, and then he sometimes presents a different or a more middling position privately. So we've seen this act before. We've seen it just about every election cycle from one candidate or another. Sometimes the victor, sometimes not. You would think that Illinois Republican primary voters would get wise to this, but I guess there's a contingent banking that they don't.
Well, they will. We have to see, but I guess it's always a surprise here. I think there are some, as I've been on here and have heard from some of the candidates directly, they have some pretty good ideas, pro-growth and pro-growth and some pension reform and things like that. So I just hope their voices are heard and then there's better competition across all of them. I mean, really what it is, the primary is a competition for ideas and hopefully, they move the ideas to what we need, but we'll have to wait and see if that happens.
I know you don't like sort of flim-flam, ephemeral public policy that is sort of dressed up press release politics. So how do you view what a few states have done, which is to suspend the state gas tax during this period of high gas prices, and the calls in Illinois and the proposals, I guess, from some legislators to do the same here, to suspend the gas tax after Pritzker doubled it a couple years back?
Yeah, I mean, the gas tax is really different. It depends on what state you're in. And let me I just drove down to Florida. I left Illinois into Indiana. It was 30 cents cheaper. Mm-hmm. Then I got into Tennessee and it was 40 cents cheaper. And then Alabama, 40 cents cheaper. It's so much cheaper. So, I think when some states talk about some gas tax relief, they're doing it off of a much lower base of taxes. So they do it for a couple of years. That might feel like it's just a short-term thing. And maybe that's okay. Our gas taxes right now are $0.73 higher than Missouri, so we don't need like a two cent savings or something like that Pritzker proposed. And that's not even a saving; that's the not raising it. We need real cuts. But this all ties back into that capital bill, $45 billion, the biggest capital bill ever. all that stuff that's going on for different districts, all that spending that nobody really understands. It's a lot of phony spending backed by really high gas taxes. We need real reform, and we're not going to get that. I'd love to see it, but what we don't need is some temporary thing. We need a cut, a big cut.
Well, yeah, I mean, Mayor Lightfoot's thinking of reducing, rolling back the gas tax 3 cents a gallon here in Chicago. That's not going to do anything.
Yeah.
Ted, you're cutting out on us again. You've moved.
Uh-oh.
You moved.
Uh-oh.
Shouldn't have moved.
We told you not to move.
My apologies.
All right.
Ted, don't breathe.
All right, last chance. We'll see.
You said I have a great connection, but I don't know.
All right. Well, we'll leave it
there. He must be in Florida.
We get the gist of your position. Go enjoy the beach. Ted Dabrowski, president, wirepoints.com, all things Illinois policy related. Thanks, Ted.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Brooklyn Nets star Kyrie Irving pretty happy to be on the basketball court after New York City Mayor Eric Adams lifted the vax mandate on athletes and performers.
But it was so goofy. If you lived in New York, you couldn't play. But if you were visiting from out of town and you were unvaccinated, you could play.
And he could also go to the games, which he did. Kevin, that's the point Kevin Durant made. And then he was chastised by Michael Wilbon. We discussed that. Here's Kyrie Irving, happy to be back.
Of this season, for me, it was never to just take a stand. It was really to make sure that I'm standing on what I believe in and freedom. Freedom. I don't think that's a word that gets defined enough in our society, about the freedom to make choices with your life without someone telling you what the f- to do. And whether that carries over into nuances of our society that, politicians control, the government controls, or things people that empower, the powers may be, right, that control. I'm standing for freedom.
I nominate Kyrie Irving for director of NIH to replace the retiring Tony Fauci.
He's not retiring yet.
No, of course not.
Oh, don't tease us like that.
He's
Dan.
Got much
That's
more
so
to contribute. So Kyrie Irving can play, but without getting vaxxed. But not so much the case for other private sector employees in New York City, as well as city workers like police and fire.
It's ridiculous.
That doesn't seem right, does it? I don't know. For some help with this conundrum, pleased to be joined again by Dr. Joel Zinberg, Competitive Enterprise Institute Senior Fellow, Director of Public Health and American Well-Being Initiative at the Paragon Health Institute. Dr. Zinberg, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So what do you think about what Kyrie had to say and why it only applies to him and other athletes and theatrical performers, and not the hoi polloi in NYC?
Well, it really makes very little sense. You know, Kyrie was subjected to two different mandates. The first one required anyone entering an indoor venue, including basketball arenas, to be vaccinated. And that's what, back in the fall, kept him from playing at all of the Brooklyn Nets home games. And in fact, the team didn't want him to be a part-time player, so they kept him out of all of their games and practices, and they had to relent on that when Omicron came around and infected all of their vaccinated players, and they couldn't even put forward a complete roster. So they had started to allow him to play on the road. And then the city got rid of that mandate, but they still had another mandate that Bill de Blasio imposed on his way out the door, which required workers at New York City businesses to show proof of vaccination. And that's the one that Mayor Adams has just lifted, but only for professional athletes and performers. And it, you know, makes no sense when you had to lay off 1,430 essential city workers, including policemen, firemen, teachers, and there are maybe thousands more who could be laid off because they still have their exemption applications pending. So it doesn't make any sense.
Well, also, too, I mean, this is at the same time that Eric Adams is running around saying that New York City is, of the snake Plissken variety. It's escape from New York. It's lawlessness. We're going back to broken windows. Hey, maybe you want some of those police officers who didn't get vaxxed back on the force.
Yeah, you'd think so. And, you know, the city does not have an exemption for people who can demonstrate immunity because they were infected with COVID before. And we know that natural immunity is just as good as vaccine immunity. So the policy doesn't make sense. And, it kind of looks like Adams is going to relent on this. But I suspect there's an element of him not wanting to give the appearance of backing down to city employees who refused vaccination orders because an awful lot of their colleagues obeyed those orders. So, I think this is coming, but the reality is that at this point in time in the pandemic, vaccines do very little to protect you from becoming infected. With each successive wave of new variants, the vaccines have gotten less effective in protecting you from infection. Now, they still are very effective in protecting you from getting ill, seriously ill and requiring hospitalization and maybe even going on to die, but they don't protect you against infection. So you're not really protecting anyone in the workplace from getting infected and going on to infect other people.
Well, then we're continuing with this craziness because the FDA is expected to authorize a second booster shot for people 50 and older.
Right. They're going to authorize it, but presumably not necessarily recommended. I mean, because the evidence there is pretty weak on a second booster shot. All the booster shots really do is give you a temporary boost in your antibodies. So for a month or two, you have higher protection against infection. They don't, if you are, healthy, no underlying medical problems, they really do very little beyond that. There are subgroups of people, maybe the very old or people who are immunocompromised or have lots of underlying medical problems for whom the boosters, may do more in terms of protecting you from serious illness. But for most people, they really do very little.
Yeah, but it's the spring and summer. I mean, this isn't even flu season technically, or COVID season or variant season, whatever you want to call it. Like, why would we wait until next year when flu season comes around?
Yeah, I mean, you never know with COVID. For example, the Delta wave of COVID really took place in the summer. So the COVID doesn't necessarily follow the same seasonal pattern as flu. It may, but we do have at least one example of where it didn't. So you couldn't rely on that so much. But in terms of boosters, it seems like a silly policy for most people.
But here's the thing. I don't know if this is strictly a medical question, but if you're a COVIDian and you don't get the third and the fourth and continue to get these boosters, then how are you going to be able to demonstrate your moral superiority and heroism over the less thans if you're not required to wave that vax pass around showing your updated status?
Well, then there's a simple answer. You just wear a mask.
That was a joke. Yeah,
that's a good
way to do. No, it's a good proxy. Yeah, I like maybe gloves. Maybe go back to the gloves.
Scrubbing down
every surface.
Yeah, I still I don't know. Do you see the New York? I just went to a breakfast joint in Chicago near where I live, and the employees are all with the masks and the gloves. What is happening there? Slow learners. A doctor?
I think there's become a real, what's called performative aspect here that, you want to show that you're doing the right thing. You want to make people feel comfortable. And if you're a business, I suppose, and you think you're going to lose customers if your employees are not wearing masks, you tell your people to wear masks. So, that's as things go, I suppose it's probably not doing a lot, but it's not hurting people terribly much.
Yeah.
Well,
forcing people to undergo medical procedures and get, boosters and, third and fourth shots, that's a different animal than just wearing a mask.
Well, doctor, I want you to know that our barista at Ashland and Irving finally went from wearing two masks to wearing one mask.
It's slow. It takes, it takes time to pull people out.
Well, I tell them pray for them. I'm like, I pray for you guys that you read something. I have 150 plus studies in my car. I'm like, I can give you one or two.
Just tell them
to see the efficiency of masks.
Just to tell them to watch that Scientology documentary and see if any resonance.
That's not the only, we're doing, there's an awful lot of things we're still doing that don't make a lot of sense. If you want to travel to the United States, for example, from overseas, you have to demonstrate a negative COVID test.
I know. And flights, which
makes very little sense anymore. Yeah, I've written an article about that. I also, this masking on airplanes makes very little sense anymore. The airplanes are the safest indoor environment in the world. So we're still doing an awful lot of things if you want to be charitable, you just want to say that the public health advice hasn't caught up with the science. If you're less charitable, you say this is to demonstrate that the government's doing something.
Mm-hmm. And we're still quarantining people at CPS. We still have hundreds out even today that are healthy. I mean, there's no end in sight.
Well, they also, this is also, demonstrating they're doing something, and demonstrated what they have been doing was the correct thing to have done.
Right, right.
Yeah. I want to get to your take on something else. It's a bit off topic. It includes this, but it's bigger. And, this is this troubling development of private interest controlling offices of public function. We talked about this in the election with respect to, for example, Mark Zuckerberg paying for employees to be in governmental units, the Zucker boxes for ballots and so on and so forth. This is in the science space, and it's a Politico report. Eric Schmidt, the former CEO of Google, who's worth, $20 billion, and his influence over the White House's Office of Science and Technology Policy. The report in Politico, more than a dozen officials in the 140-person White House office have been associates of Schmidt's and his foundation. Schmidt's maintained a close relationship with the president's former science advisor, a guy named Eric Lander. His charity arm, Schmidt Futures, indirectly paid the salaries of two science office employees, White House science office employees, including for 6 weeks, that of the current chief of staff. Do you worry at all about sort of private interests capturing public institutions in government?
Look, you obviously don't want one individual, whether they're private or government, over-influencing things. We have some pretty good experience with having happened with someone like Anthony Fauci. You hope that that doesn't happen, but you have a guy like Eric Schmidt who donates to and funds all sorts of things, including scientific things, and it becomes kind of inevitable that he'll have a lot of influence, the same way that the Chan Zuckerberg Foundation has tremendous influence because they fund all sorts of health-related things. So, I would hope that, they're not allowing that to happen, but it is a bit concerning.
Yeah, I mean, then, the next thing you got Bill Gates saying everybody in the first world has to eat synthetic beef.
Right.
I mean, So, yeah.
It's got a lot of preservatives in it. I would stay away from it.
But it's just like sort of the concept. I mean, it's a question about concentration of power, and we talk about that in a political sense a lot, but not necessarily with respect to science, although more so after COVID. And this is really important because you have, policy that may be being made on behalf of very narrow interests, financial or even just sort of power interests. And it's not limited, as you said, to private sector. We also have concerns about how beholden the scientific community is to the National Institutes for Health because they're so dependent on the grant funding there. So to your point about it being public or private.
Right. I mean, the problem, of course, is always that when it becomes a private individual, the recipients of their money may then become people who want to project their benefactors' political views, and that's really what we have to worry about. So, to the extent that you have someone like a Schmidt, who is, for example, a big Hillary Clinton supporter, pushing a particular line and a particular approach to public health, that is somewhat worrisome.
He is Dr. Joel Zinberg, Competitive Enterprise Institute Senior Fellow and Director of Public Health and American Well-Being in the American Well-Being Initiative at Paragon Health Institute. Dr. Zinberg, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So you heard from Alex Stein, Primetime Stein 99.
Primetime 99.
He made a passionate presentation before the Plano, Texas City Council, arguing that he should be able to swim with the Plano, Texas Women's Swim League.
Yeah, the Park District's Women's Swim League. Maybe. He wants in. And he wore a bathing suit and a cap and goggles and, you know, made a passionate speech.
To give him the opportunity to perhaps earn a college scholarship.
He was advocating for himself, and you got to respect that.
Now, this other gentleman you heard from earlier in the week, who I think was before, was it Richardson, Texas City Council? I think Alex Stein and this guy who identified himself as Marty Epstein earlier in the week. I don't know how he's identifying himself before Plano, but he followed Primetime Stein to also talk about trans rights. And, you know, he has a different approach, but it's no less passionate.
I am offended that our children are not receiving affordable gender reassignment surgery along with hormone blockers and access to abortions. This alone is a threat to our democracy, as Justin Trudeau only says. It just shows that you people do not care about our children, and that these are the same people who refuse to obey the science and get fully vaccinated. It's science, people! Science! Science!
And
you are selfish murderers. I could die. Don't you people care about my life? You racist, insensitive, homophobic pigs! My 14-year-old openly gay sibling's transgender offspring also has two daddies who love them, their offspring so much. And CPS is working overtime to take their child away. However, my biggest concern is that my sibling's offspring isn't allowed to play in the 8-year-old girls' basketball league at the YMCA. This alone is showcasing the worst form of transphobia and is a threat to our democracy. My sibling's transgender offspring feels like an 8-year-old girl. Therefore, they should be able to play in the 8-year-old girls league. Imagine living in a world where a little transgender offspring isn't allowed to follow their dreams because of transphobic Trump supporters and science deniers and conspiracy theorists. I still have nightmares every single night because of the hateful things that Donald Trump said on Twitter. I praise Joe Biden for having the courage and decency to stand up and say that poor kids are just as bright as white kids. In this previous election, decency was on the ballot, and that's what I voted for, not this racist dictator, Donald Trump, the orange man.
Your time is up. No, your time is up. Thank you.
Yeah, he
took a knee for George Floyd.
Just like he did in Richardson, Texas.
I'll just reiterate that we strive to conduct ourselves.
What was he wearing again?
It's very emotional. It's very emotional times. Oh, he was wearing a Hillary for President t-shirt with rainbow suspenders. Mm-hmm. And he had a spiked
collar
on as well. I assume that was in honor of his 14-year-old
transgender nephew
with two dads. I think earlier in the week it was a 6-year-old. So that kid is aging rapidly.
Yeah.
But no, very emotional appeals on behalf of boys and girls sports and the vaccine.
I think they listened
so
too. You know, they really caught their attention.
No, I mean, you know, you can't ignore that kind of appeal. Mm-hmm. It's powerful.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Sports and politics and sports and politics and sports and politics and
intersection.
Arrogance and ignorance. Arrogance, ignorance, and arrogance and ignorance.
Intersection.
Well, Dan and Amy, on this installment of Sports and Politics, applying the Rooney Rule to women.
Yeah. This is my dream come true, guys. This is how it's going to end here at the station, and I'm going to start my new career.
You know what the Rooney Rule is in the NFL. We talked about it most recently with respect to the lawsuit that Brian Flores, the former Miami Dolphins coach, filed against the NFL, saying he was fired because he was black. They're colluding against him to prevent him from getting a job in the NFL. Same people who hired him. Interesting. Anyway, this would apply that Rooney Rule, which is to say, for any front office or coaching vacancy, you need to interview qualified minority candidates. The qualified minority would include women. Would include Amy. Amy could be, for example, the next
offensive line coach
or president of the Bears. And I mean, you could hardly do a better job than what's his name?
Who is the guy?
Ted Phillips.
Oh,
you could hardly do a better, worse job than him. So, I mean, why not? But front office or coaching jobs, for women in the NFL, you have to include them in the interview process. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line.
I mean, the league announced the rule change again on Monday, explaining it wants the new assistants on the offensive side of the ball because it believes owners and GMs have trended toward hiring new head coaches from offensive backgrounds as opposed to defensive ones. Well, you know, that might disqualify me because my, you know, son's a defensive lineman and I know more about the defensive line than the offensive line. And this is also offensive because I'm a woman. I don't care. Women, this is not going to attract women to the NFL.
Why are you using the Biden sotto voce on this?
Because it's serious.
Yeah.
No, we don't care. Women don't care about this. And if I'm wrong, please call
Roger
in.
Goodell cares about it. He may or may not be a woman.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment. This is not going to attract women to watch the NFL or younger children. This is stupid. You hire the best person who's qualified for the job.
So here's how it works. Beginning this season, 32 clubs will employ a diverse person.
The
it's
so my offensive.
Favorite kind of person, female or a member of an ethnic or racial minority, to serve as an offensive assistant. This person will receive a one-year contract and work closely with the head coach and offensive staff to gain experience. Clubs will receive reimbursement from a league-wide fund toward the coach's salary for up to 2 years. And as Amy was pointing out, recent years, head coaches have predominantly come from the offensive side of the ball. We believe, says the NFL, this will assist greatly in continuing to source and identify diverse candidates earlier in their career, providing pipeline depth and further developing the diverse offensive pipeline.
Teams that already have a female or a minority on their offensive staff are already considered to have fulfilled the requirement. I mean, this is so insulting.
Why? You don't want to see we see female referees or officials in men's professional sports.
I deal with female referees all the time.
Occasionally, I mean, going back to the 80s even with the Eagles, Susan Spencer, she was the first female GM in the league. So we see them in the front office. Why don't you want to see them on the sidelines? Why are you such a misogynist? Why shouldn't the Bears immediately fire Matt Eberflus and hire you? Or
what's his name?
Or you maybe that Vanderbilt kicker who was SEC player of the week when she kicked an extra point.
So ridiculous.
What do you think? Because
it's a degrading and it's dehumanizing. It's stupid. I mean, my God, in any minority, this is going to be great. And then they're going to celebrate when they got hired. You know why you got hired? Because you're a minority.
What about the
how
women?
How does that sink in?
Forget the minority piece of it. Specifically, women. Women coaching men's sports. I mean, I know we all saw Wildcats. We love Goldie Hawn. It was a fun story. Women coaching men's sports at the collegiate or professional level.
Well, I'm
not talking about some little league operation. I'm not talking about parents doing a rotation. I'm talking about serious. I'm not denigrating it, but we're talking about a different thing. We're talking about serious money-making sports, men's sports. So at the collegiate level, that's football and basketball, and obviously the professional level, that would include a few more. That's what I'm talking about. What do you think?
I think I could coach basketball at the collegiate level.
You can probably coach for the Bulls, but yeah, okay, all right.
I'd be better at men's volleyball, but yeah, it's I mean, this is just so degrading. And if any, I mean, God, I hope my sisters out there don't apply for these jobs.
Do you not want women to coach in the NFL, or you just don't want them to be designated as a protected class that needs
the token? Coach. They're not going to be taken seriously because the reason why they were hired is because they're a minority or a female.
Well, what? Well, I mean, the Rooney Rule applies to black candidates and other minority groups, ethnic or racial minority groups. If you expand it to women, does that undermine black or, I mean, mainly black? But I mean, like, I don't know, Ron Rivera, not that he was a Rooney Rule hire, but, you know, but people that are ethnic minorities or racial minorities, does that undermine their street cred in the NFL?
It's pitting people against each other, cultures against each other, gender against different races.
Tony, Southside.
And then they're going to celebrate the person, you know, do an ISO on them at a game, and the announcers and the booth will say, oh, look, here's, you know.
Here's the first Trina female Smith. Coach here's in NFL first... history.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She's going to have that added pressure to do well. But if she succeeds, you know what? Fine. Prove me wrong.
Tony, Southside. Tony.
Okay, well, I'm sorry. Can you hear me?
Yeah,
hold on.
Yeah.
All right. I'm going to use the Chuck rule. I'm gonna say hello to Amy first, my Lammy Lamb, and the future coach of the Cleveland Browns.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you.
And Dan. So here's my question. I was always confused by this. So a minority, according to the Oxford Dictionary, is a smaller number or part, especially a number that is less than a half of a whole number. Are there more men in this country than women, or in the world for that matter? Why do you refer to women as minorities?
Tony, how dare you?
I certainly dare.
How dare you not recognize that the world is controlled by a patriarchy, heterosexual, cisgendered, white, privileged men like you who keep the majority down? It's not about numbers, Tony, from the South Side.
Tony,
it's about
Tony.
Power.
Well, let me expound on this, okay?
Why shouldn't 52%? Why shouldn't 52% of the head coaches in the NFL be women then, Tony?
Here's the other thing. The other definition of a minority is also in the state of period of being underage or full legal responsibility. In terms of, like you said, hierarchy or a king that's, you know, opposing his will. That's not the case here.
Yeah, well,
I don't see it. You're going to convince me.
Well, fine. Then we should. Thanks for the call, Tony. That's fine. You're making my point for me. Then it should be teenage girls coaching NFL teams.
You know what? I think I should apply. I've got a stellar coaching record right now.
Doesn't matter that it's not in football. I mean, Ted
well,
Lasso.
Yeah, but I watched.
That's a documentary. Isn't Ted Lasso a documentary? Didn't he go from
football to soccer?
Yeah.
I can. That's a transferable skill. I can go from boys varsity volleyball to an offensive line position with the Bears. Supplement my salary, my income. I think I could get a new hobo ride.
You think you could be a line coach for the Bears?
Well, I've watched football for the past, 8 years?
That's good enough for me.
No.
That's good enough for the front office there, as far as I can tell.
And my son is on the offensive line, not defensive line. Sorry, Peyton, I got that wrong.
The lines, you know. You're perfect.
I know lines. I know circles, and I know squares. Will you hire me?
There's no evidence that the Bears have any line coaches for the last several years. I mean, or they knew, you know, which side of the ball Khalil Mack was on. I mean,
I should do this. And not just be radio, but I really should seriously go after this.
I think so. Remember, you get a paid, essentially, internship. Yeah. You serve as an assistant to the offensive assistant coach. Yeah, you get, I'm sure.
Well, I have a driver to pick me up.
I don't know about a driver. Well, you'll be up in Deerfield or then over in Arlington Heights if you make it to the second year. All right.
Yeah. Maybe. You got to get those pants, right? Those polyester cotton blend coaching pants that men wear that is just god awful.
Well, get the Belichick hoodie with the sleeves cut off. Show them you're serious. Jerry, Harwood Heights, or as our producer Quinn calls it, Howard Heights. Jerry.
Howard, yes.
Yeah.
Good morning, gang. How's everybody doing this morning?
Oh, we're great. Thank you.
Maybe they should, maybe the NFL should pull the Joe Biden rule. Make the coach be female and black.
Okay. All right. That's sort of where they're going. Yeah. I don't know if there's like a bump in salary if you're depending on your intersectional score, but yeah.
I mean, is it hard to coach a sport you haven't played, though? I'm really contemplating this because I played basketball, I played volleyball, so I had a feel for it.
Yeah. You've watched football.
Oh, since I was a little kid.
I mean, I think.
You know, I understand football, but it took a long time.
A friend of mine, his son just got hired as a defensive back coach for the Bears. He was a defensive back coach at Northwestern. And in the interview, they threw him in a room and they had him break down film, tell us what's happening here. But you've watched Troy Aikman on the Telestrator. I mean, you could do the same thing. This guy missed that coverage.
I've watched a lot of Amundsen football in my time.
Yeah, you know a nickel package from
I know the Statue of Liberty.
Yeah, you know, right, sure.
I know the naked bootleg.
You can be on both sides of the ball. Yeah.
I could impress them with that.
Mike in Milwaukee. Hey, Mike.
Hey, greetings. I think I should be able to sign up for this job with the NFL because I self-identify as a woman coach.
There you go. Yeah, all right. Well, that's a start.
Wear the pants.
Dan, Southwest Side.
Hey, sorry, it's been a while. I was getting my male vagina candled the last couple of weeks.
All right.
I suggest a screening process that our high school coaches used to do. We'd shower after gym class, and they just look at us and talk about the bodies that they want to put in the weight room. I think it's a great way to hire the females, too.
There you go. Yeah, thanks for the call, Dan. Yeah, real rite of passage is what you're saying. I get it.
Oh, this is bad.
So it treats you as one of the guys.
Yeah.
I don't see gender.
Uh-huh.
I understand that's the same thing that Lori Lightfoot does with her inner circle, steam room.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. She's got it. Going on, man.
You know, she's got to be comfortable with one another in the natural state. Mike, Southside.
Morning, Dan. Morning, Amy. This is only the beginning. Just wait till the NFL tells the teams to start hiring somebody who's transgender.
Well, I know. I think that should be included. Thanks for the call, Mike. I'm surprised that actually wasn't. Female or a member of an ethnic or racial minority is what constitutes a diverse person, according to the NFL. Now, obviously, you get into what is the definition of a female. Very few people know this. We have, you know, as Supreme Court nominees are not clear on this. So we're going to need clarity from Roger Goodell and the league owners on this, whether or not you could have, say, a Caitlyn Jenner be a football coach.
Mm-hmm.
You could have a Leah Thomas swim and be a football coach.
Oh, my God. I bet you don't give her an idea. I bet you she's going to.
She could be the Jackie Robinson of swimming
and
football coaching. I mean, do we have some assistant coaches in the NFL that are females? I know there's a Jets coach a couple years ago.
Yeah, there's one for the Bengals, I thought, too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I mean, you know, and we do have male coaches for women's sports. I mean, Bill Laimbeer coached in the WNBA for a long time. And maybe he still does. Who knows? Because who watches? But, I mean, you have men's coaches for women's basketball and so on and so forth. So, I mean, what's the difference, right? Is there any difference? Is there any difference women coaching, like Gina Rima coaching UConn, than it would be for, say, Pat Summitt, the great Tennessee Vols coach who's passed on, unfortunately, who coaching Duke. Any difference? Good coaches in their respective with their respective teams, build championship records. Any difference, do you think?
Well,
Michael in Rockford.
You know, I wonder how many years will it take before it's a requirement that a woman is on the active roster?
Yeah. Thanks for the call, Michael. Starter, active roster, is that enough? Diverse person has to be at least one diverse person on the offensive side, one person on the defensive side. I don't know. I mean, when you start counting by race and gender, where do you stop? Nobody knows. Tom in Blue Island.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. Dan, if you remember Jim Rome, maybe he would be a good nominee for one of these diversity jobs. If you remember, he tried gendering Jim Everett back on his show, you know, maybe 20 years ago. That didn't work out so well.
Jim Everett didn't give him a Will Smith bitch slap. He knocked him over. I remember that. Right? Jim Everett from Purdue. Purdue standout.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. Oh, Jim Everett and Jim Rome. Hmm. All right, well, let's pull together your resume. We've got to get some tape, some highlights from your coaching, some of your sideline work for the
conference
volleyball.
Champs for
basketball. Yeah. Put together your trophies.
14 years of playing, yeah. Got a lot of championships for middle school. Do you think they'll take that into account?
What about you? You got to know, you know, back in the day when you were, you know, ruling the roost with Anna DeVlantes and Adelie Martinez, when you ladies were the hottest thing this side of the Mississippi.
Yeah, we were pretty good looking back then.
Yeah.
Real lookers. We're the Rat Pack.
You had to be hanging out with the 85 Bears.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So what about some testimonials? What about going back
Al Harris. I talked to Al.
Talked to Al Harris. Talked to Otis.
Richard Dent.
Talked to Wilbur. Talked to the sack man. Talked to Hampton.
Mm-hmm.
Gary Fensick. Talked to him. He's still around. You know, get some testimonials. Say, should give
she's the real deal.
Amy J.
No, the guys respect me. I mean, I'm coaching the boys team, and they had a male coach last year, and they've all told me that I've completely changed the culture, the program. They love coming to practice, and I'm all about winning.
Jim Covert, Jimbo Covert, Kurt Becker.
I'm being serious, and you're kind of mocking me.
No, I'm trying
to tell you about my accolades and my accomplishments, and you're making fun of me.
Where's Jay Dogg, Jay Hilgenberg?
I could call what's his name?
You could call.
Mongo.
Well.
Well, no, I've got his cell phone number.
Yes.
I love Mongo.
But you know who you could call. Come on.
Who?
The coach.
Oh, Dicka? Who I thought was.
The coach.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure he'll love the advancement of females in sports coaching. He's all over that.
He's the original feminist in the NFL.
You know what? I should have him. I'll reach out to him.
You should
call in tomorrow.
Call the coach and ask him if he'll vouch for you with the Bears organization.
Dijon, time that we gave some polarizage, eh?
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.